drive.
Okay. First person, if we're going from right to left, is Bill Weinberg, who will be speaking on whatever.
I have to be a little bit brief here, because after me, we have Eric Lawson of New York City Direct Action Network, Jay Underhill of the public access TV show Anarchist Propaganda and Variety Hour, and Sylvia Federici of the Committee for Academic Freedom in Africa, and author and feminist. Since we've started on a philosophical note, apparently, I'd like to point out that there's two kinds of intelligence. There's cleverness, and there's wisdom. And we need both, because we're facing really, really powerful enemies, and they're extremely clever. So we have to develop some cleverness to counter their cleverness, but we also have to be very wise about how we go about it. And I don't purport to be wise, but before we, if I can just start off by asking a question. How many folks here subscribe to my weekly newsletter, World War III Report? Good. All right. Anybody who hasn't, rather than reading yet another email address out, I'm going to ask you to see me afterwards, and I'll give you the email address. But this newsletter is endeavoring to decipher exactly what the imperialist agenda in Central Asia is. Because without a doubt, there is an imperialist agenda which is at work here. But before we get to bashing U.S. imperialism, which is usually, you know, Chomsky's raison d'etre, and it's very uncharacteristic for him to delve off into philosophy like that, but I think in some ways the times call for it. Because in addition to being clever enough to figure out what the imperialist agenda is, we have to be wise enough to figure out how to oppose it. And it seems to me that, and seemed to me from the beginning, from the very first day that this happened, and the whole predictable monstrosity of a massive military response in Afghanistan seemed inevitable. Just as soon as we got the news about what had happened at the World Trade Center, it's occurred to me that the first principle that we have to assert, and a very obvious principle, is that attacks on civilians are not acceptable under any circumstances. And this is obvious on the face of it, and yet there's a sort of, it's so obvious that you sort of don't see the forest for the trees. And there's something sort of counterintuitive about it, because while everybody is so upset about the 3,000, almost 4,000 civilians that were lost here in a single day in New York City on September 11th, the anti-war opposition, let's face it, is extremely marginalized. And the majority of the population, at least seems, here in New York City and more generally in this country, the majority of the population seems to accept that it is perfectly appropriate for our military to be destroying innocent civilians in Afghanistan in order to assert the principle that it's not appropriate to kill innocent civilians. Now, this is doublethink. This is straight out of Orwell. It is impossible to assert the principle that innocent civilians should not be killed by killing innocent civilians. But there are reasons why this readily apparent, obvious reality is so occluded by propaganda. Even though you sort of can't say it all in one breath, this is nonetheless what this is the consensus which has been created, is that it's perfectly acceptable and appropriate for our government to be doing this. So when I oppose this and people ask me, well, what do you think we should do? The first thing I say is that we should stop using that pronoun, because we are not the government. And we need to somehow make the point to the rest of the world that our government is not acting with our consent and without our complicity. And most importantly, we have to withdraw that complicity by whatever means we can, and throw ourselves in the, you know, into the gears of the war machine to whatever extent possible. And in terms of advancing, you know, an agenda, an alternative agenda, because no, you know, because the next question is always, well, and do you think we should do nothing? Well, no, we can't accept a passivist with a V as opposed to an F, a passivist stance. And you know, we need to vigorously put forth a program. And the program which the sort of general and loosely defined program, which, you know, just to put in a little sound bite for propaganda purposes, is that I've been putting forth is that what we have to do, we as a nation, is get off of the fossil fuel economy as fast as possible, disentangle ourselves from the volatile politics of the Middle East, and generally withdraw our global tentacles, both economic and military. and that's where it gets a little bit more complicated, and that's where the cleverness comes in, because that's where you have to decipher exactly what those tentacles are and exactly what they're doing. And I'm not going to talk too long, because at the last anarchist forum we did here, the last forum that the Libertarian Book Club did here, I spoke about it at great length. But I did bring my trusty mat. So just to briefly go over, before we move on to the next panelists, what in fact the objective realities are of what the tentacles of U.S. imperialism have been doing in this part of the world for a long time. For the past 200 years, there's been the so-called Great Game, which has been played out over Afghanistan, beginning in the, as soon as Afghanistan achieved its independence from the Mughal Empire in the late 18th century, the British were moving into India, which then included Pakistan, and colonizing it. At about the same time, the Russians were coming in from the north and colonizing Turkestan, the Turkic region of Central Asia. And Afghanistan was the border between these two opposing empires. And they each cultivated proxy forces and had their proxy wars going on in Afghanistan for, 150 years. And this, basically, as we all know, after the Second World War, the U.S. stepped in and into the boots of British imperialism and started cultivating Pakistan as a proxy state and playing out the proxy war to keep the Soviets at bay, who were in turn attempting to cultivate Afghanistan as their proxy state. So the great game continued, and finally the Soviets invaded Afghanistan in 1979, and the U.S. began arming the Mujahideen, the Islamic fundamentalist rebels who were trying to kick the Russians out of Afghanistan. And this was a part of a long-term agenda which was made explicitly clear, particularly by the writings of Zbigniew Brzezinski, of establishing American control over the Central Asian heartland, over what used to be known as Turkestan, and is once again known as Turkestan. It used to be called the Soviet Union in between. And this big area becomes even more strategic, of course, with the discovery of vast reserves of oil in the Caspian Basin. So in 1989, the Mujahideen is victorious and kicks the Soviet occupation out of Afghanistan, and in fact actually brings the war north, and Islamic uprisings and insurgencies begin in Tajikistan and Uzbekistan, the former Soviet republics as well. So the CIA's long-term agenda is working like a charm. Everything is going quite well. And Bill Casey also had been extremely explicit as early as the early 1980s, that the agenda was, in fact, to destabilize destabilize the Soviet Union itself from the south after the Russians had been kicked out of Afghanistan. And, in fact, this began to happen. Then, in the subsequent years, you had the Mujahideen government of Bernardudan Rabbani in power in Afghanistan. Afghanistan was pretty much left to its own devices. The whole proxy war continued, but it was downsized. Much less money and much less arms are actually involved, because it was this whole geostrategic pullback of both the forces of the U.S. and the Soviet Union. Soviet Union, whose days were numbered at this point, as we all know. Just at about the same time that Rabbani's regime, which was comparatively moderate, although still quite extremist by our standards, were destabilized by the Taliban. Taliban took power in 1996 and began their reign of terror, which put Rabbani's to shame. At just about the same time, the U.S. oil companies were moving in and cutting their deals with the now independent states of post-Soviet Central Asia. Chevron cut its deal with Kazakhstan, and hired Dick Cheney as their advisor to sort of grease the negotiations between between Chevron and Kazakhstan. Unocal cut their deal with Turkmenistan and hired Henry Kissinger for similar purposes. And it was Unocal which immediately began wheeling and dealing with the connivance of the CIA and the State Department with the Taliban regime to build a pipeline through Afghanistan down to the Pakistani port of Karachi to get the oil to market so the oil would not have to go through Russia. So Russia would not have to get their cut, and so the oil also would not have to go through Iran, and Iran would not have to get their cut. And eventually, I guess they found that they couldn't deal with the Taliban, although all of their efforts to try to do so, to try to cut a deal with the Taliban, were have been extensively documented by this point. In fact, the Taliban was also cooperating with U.S. imperialism in terms of further attempts to destabilize Russia and further reduce its sphere of influence. They were working together to a certain extent in the wars in Chechnya and in Georgia, in the Caucasus. But finally, push came to shove, and they had some kind of falling out. And this is where it's up to us to be clever enough to figure out what's really going on here. And all of a sudden, Osama bin Laden and the Taliban, who were very carefully groomed by the CIA for many years to meet the mutual aid of kicking the Russians out of Afghanistan and putting a compliant regime in power in Afghanistan, are now all of a sudden our enemies. And this horrific attack on the civilian population and the land and the ecology and the sovereignty of Afghanistan is being carried out in our name. So we have to figure out what the hell is really going on here and what we can do about it. And to help us do that, we have this panel tonight. So without further ado, I'm going to move on to Eric Lawson of New York City Direct Action Network.
Thanks.
And Eric has been a writer.
I'm glad that Bill gave this introduction, because now there's a lot of things that I can just assume everyone knows and just speak on a high level. There's other things that are available for free if you ask about it afterwards. About a month or so after the war started, I wrote a piece called Against the War, Against the State, Why Anarchists Oppose the War Against Terrorism. And it was a sort of a talking points for anarchists about the war, because I felt that there's lots of good reasons to be against this war, but there are elements of the anarchist agenda that specifically address the war, and there are reasons to be against the war that I think are more cogent when you look at it from an anarchist point of view than any other. And when I was looking this over the other day, I had absolutely no reason to think that I ought to revise any of it. In spite of the fact that bin Laden is on the run and the CIA has set up a house in Kabul and so forth, I don't think anything has changed any of the things that I wrote in this. And I was going to, until about an hour ago, I was going to simply expound a bit on the points that I have in this. If you want a copy of it, you can talk to me afterwards, and I'd be glad to email it to you. But I, all of a sudden, got a really strong idea that if I wanted to, I could bash the left as part of this. And I like to bash the left sometimes, so I'm going to do that as well. To start out with, I think that to understand what's going on here, you have to go back to someone who was not an anarchist but was a kind of a fellow traveler of anarchists during the World War I period, Randolph Bourne. He wrote an essay called The State, which was unfinished when he died. But the key phrase that's become a kind of a catchphrase since then is, war is the health of the state. And I think that a lot of the analysis that we need to do of what's going on here really begins and ends with that statement. This is not a war against terrorism. It's a war to extend the American empire and its economic system. The point of this war is not to avenge the deaths of some people who died in the World Trade Center, thousands of people. It's to, or to get retribution for them even. It's to create an opportunity. It was to take that and use it as an opportunity to extend American economic and political influence into Central Asia, which is an area that as far back as the 70s, the United States was very concerned to wrest away from the Soviet Union. It's not a Soviet Union anymore, but it's an economic rival, and the United States wants to essentially put that region into its sphere of influence. This is all about an expansion of the state. At the same time, there's a statement that Dick Cheney made that I think we all have to keep in mind, which is that, and I don't think it's sunk into the American public at all yet, which is that this is a war which may not end in our lifetimes. And I don't think he just meant himself. I think he meant people who are a lot younger than him. This is maybe the most perfect war that any state has ever devised. It's Orwellian. It's about permanent war that can go on as long as the definition, as long as anything can possibly be defined as war. There's a very good essay by Lewis Lapham in Harper's this month in which he says the United States might as well have declared war on sloth and greed and indolence and pledged to destroy them sometime in the near to distant future. And that is, of course, what the United States is going to do, is to stretch the definition as far as it can, for as long as it can. Orwellian is not too strong a word. The irony, of course, is that the state, any state, and I don't mean just the United States, is always the biggest terrorist there is on the block. And this goes back to the Spanish in the Americas in the 16th century. It goes back to the British in the Caribbean in the 17th, 18th centuries. It goes to Russia in the Gulag. It goes to Nazi Germany. The state is always the greatest terrorist.
Goes back to the Assyrians.
It goes back to the Assyrians, right. There is no greater terrorist than the state. And the United States, if you look at how it pursues its agenda all around the globe, is certainly proving that out. A state is essentially an entity that's put together by an elite to dominate society. That elite is not just politicians, it's corporate bosses. It's inherited wealth. You can run down the list. This war is essentially, as Bill pointed out, in terms of the connections between the oil companies and government, it's an opportunity for one part of the elite to scratch the back of the other. And these groups are interchangeable. They're in politics. They're on corporate boards. They're one and the same ruling class. And they're pursuing their interests not just politically but economically in Central Asia. The answer to this is that if we're going to build a better society, as Bill mentioned, let's get off of fossil fuels. But that's just really the beginning. That's just one aspect of it. We have to build a more just society from the ground up. And that's where, as anarchists, I think that we have something very particular to say. You can't do it by taking over the state and reforming the state. You can't do it by creating a better state. You can only do it by creating something outside of the state, because the logic of the state is that it will pursue its interests and the interests of the elite that controls it. That means a number of other things. That means that, for one thing, Americans have to lose a certain amount of cultural isolation that they have. They have to start understanding the second largest religion in the world, for example, and not think of it as some freakish thing that ought to disappear. When the world becomes enlightened, will disappear, which I think is at gut level the way most Americans view Islam. We're not going to get past that until we can get past the power that the state exercises to make us hate whenever it's convenient for us to hate a certain group. Again, as Bill said, this is a war that's being fought to sustain an unsustainable economy, an oil economy. The only way to have security in a situation like this is to take ourselves off of dependency of a resource that our elite is fighting to control in order to keep us hooked on it. It's as simple as that. There's a very tight connection between oil and the state and the fact that we have a state. You can go a little bit further even. Media. Why are the messages that are being circulated about this war being circulated? Because the media is controlled by a cartel that's controlled by the same elite. The WEF meeting next at the end of this month is going to be covered not by alternative media, not by the Independent Media Center in New York, or any non-hierarchical group like that. It's going to be covered primarily by reporters who are accredited by organizations that are members of the WEF. Okay, that's how the elite gets covered. It gets covered by organizations that are part of itself. We need to stop supporting that media and start supporting independent media. That's part of the same equation. As far as bashing the left goes, okay, a lot of what I'm saying, I'm making an argument here that in order to oppose this war, you have to, in a way, be an anarchist. Now, why is that? Well, I don't have to go very far for the evidence. The evidence is in The Nation, where the editorial a few weeks ago said that there's a silver lining to this war, which is that it's proving to the American public that that privatizing public services is not a good idea. In other words, our public services have done very well for us since the war started. Isn't the military a public service? Aren't we taking the people who provide airport security into the government now? This is the rebirth of America's faith in government. This is the liberal line, and it's pathetic and it's abject. It's not a line I don't think that very many Marxists would disagree with on a certain level, because it says essentially that that in a national emergency, people rally around each other, and that's the same as rallying around the state. Again, I go back to that quote from Bourne, which is, "War is the health of the state." If you think that an inspiring moment in human history is, or the equivalent of a moment of human solidarity is rallying around the state, then fine, this is for you. But I don't think that if you look at this war very hard, you can really believe that. The funny thing about the left is that they pursue this kind of line of thinking even when it really doesn't make a lot of sense in terms of their own priorities. There was a piece which Edward J. Epstein, the investigative reporter, wrote in the Wall Street Journal editorial page on Christmas Eve, in which he said that one of the reasons for the anthrax scare is privatization. The idea of public services being alienated away from us to corporations is something that is brought along because the American anthrax found its way in the hands of a British corporation, which was privatized by Margaret Thatcher, and which was then purchased by a Saudi business person, one of whose minority shareholders was Annual Admiral William J. Crow, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So we've got a real nexus here between government, privatized public services, industry. This is something, as an anarchist, we can look at and say, all right, this shows us something about the system that controls our world, which embraces the state, which the state is merely a part of. Okay, just really quickly, why is this? Why do we see people like Susan Sontag? Why do we see people like or publications like The Nation, celeb leftist Christopher Hitchens, people like this who are famous, who people love to read when you're on the left and think this is great? Why do they support this war? I have a few crude answers for that. One is that I don't think that the advantage of being an anarchist is you can visualize action outside of the state. I think an awful lot of people on the left are so wedded to working within the system that when the system goes in a certain direction in a massive way, they can't really see working outside of it, because if they start to work outside of it, or to work in a way that has a sort of a predicate or is predicated on non-state solutions or non-state analysis, they feel as though they are cutting themselves off from the general public or from the masses. They feel as though they're endangering themselves of being marginalized, that they might not be able to participate when the state swings back to its proper senses and starts to act like it should again. You know, whenever it hasn't happened yet, but I guess they assume it will at some point. Another reason is leftist groups tend to be hierarchical. Marxist groups tend to be hierarchical. They tend to have star systems, just like a lot of other parts of society. anarchism is built on a non-hierarchical, anti-authoritarian basis where you don't have this sort of thing, where you don't have leaders who feel as though their rationale for being leaders of a leftist group is partly to enable them to participate, to be heard by the elite, and to participate as part of the elite. In anarchist organizing, that there's always a threat of that, but it's not something that's going to happen day in, day out. I would say that just in general, wartime is a time when it has been recognized. It was recognized during World War I that wartime was a time when the anarchists helped to keep the left honest. A lot of leftists supported World War I. The anarchists were consistent all along the line that this is not a war that we should support. This is a war that we are against. As working people, et cetera, we're against it. And an awful lot of people on the left forgot that lesson. It was the anarchists who kept them honest. That's Kropotkin did support the war, but he everybody slips up once in a while. Malatesta didn't support the war. Emma Goldman didn't support the war. Berkman, you know.
Does Sontag support the war?
She tacitly does. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's repented of to some extent of her the position she took in the New Yorker and said she had overstated it and is backpedaled. But anyway, I'm not here to talk about Susan Sontag. Basically, I think that it's fine that anarchists help to keep the left honest during a time of war, but I think that there's something more here. I think that where we really need to go in this situation is to appeal to people who are disturbed by what's going on and who want to become active in opposing this war, appeal to them to organize in a way that doesn't send them into the same traps that every other leftist group seems to stumble into of supporting a state solution. I think that we have to encourage non-hierarchical, non-authoritarian organizing against this war and push for it in a passionate way, because I think it's the only way that after this is all over, whenever that is, we have a chance of moving on to a system or some kind of a global order that's better than what we have now, and that's not going to be dominated by a state.
I think, are you done? Is that the
end? Yeah.
This, to relate it back to the Chomsky thing, instead of saying the state, I think that's why he's saying hegemony.
Hegemony, yes.
That hegemony against survival, hegemony is the state survival, is what it's supposed to. What we need to do is find something to support survival, not seeking for power, not seeking for control, not seeking for having your hands on everything and making it so.
And that's got to be predicated in the way we organize and the way we oppose what's going on right from the start.
All right, thank you, Eric.
And so the next person is, as was evident, the person who I work with sometimes doing the Anarchist Propaganda and Variety Hour, Jay Underhill.
Or Dobkin, I've been dropping the pseudonym lately, although what with the changes in what limited constitutional rights used to be at least made a pretense of here. Maybe it'll be better if we all use pseudonyms. But Underhill is also appropriate because, you know, it actually took the name from Tolkien, which is in the news these days.
Are we changing the name, by the way, of Anarchist Propaganda?
We
may have some other
Names are not that important. Which is one of the things I'm going to talk about here. It's substance that's important. Two things just, though, that don't really, at least are not explicitly and tightly connected with everything that I'm going to say, but are just sort of on my mind simultaneously right now. One is at my day job today, where I happen to do research on restaurant and hotel openings, which is, come the revolution, I'll be able to do things that are important, but right now that's what I do to make a living. And one of the these hotels that openings, their little article came out with it, our researcher's clip, and put in front of me so I can write up the hotel opening, was it said most hotels now, with the economy the way it is and with the war and with the terrorism and with the depression and so on, most hotels are cutting back. And we knew that, by the way, at work, that there's a lot less hotel and restaurant openings than there used to be. But there's one hotel that's going to do a huge $50 million expansion, doubling their size, down at Disney World. Among all the hotels there, the rest of them are cutting back. but there's a hotel called Shades of Green, which is run by the U.S. Army and exclusively for military personnel. I'm not going to tie this in with all the other things in my what I'm going to say, but sort of in the back of my mind there, it's this convergence of Disney World and militarism, and maybe that is something of the theme of what I'm going to say. The other thing that just on my way here, we were performing, as I said, Not in My Name in Times Square, and then I started to head down through Times Square, and on the sidewalk there, about Broadway and 55th, was this guy, very earnest-looking guy, with this hat, and he was handing out these papers and not saying anything, just giving them to whoever he could, these sheets of paper. And on his hat, I could see it said Afghan, and then I couldn't read what the rest was, you know, printed around the side from where I couldn't view it. And I thought, oh my God, another nut crawling out of the woodwork to give out some really appalling thing in Times Square. Mm-hmm. So I got a little closer, and I saw now that it said Afghan Kebab House, and he was giving out menus. And and as a vegetarian, of course, I do find that really appalling. But anyway, something, you were quoting Orwell here, and that's interesting because Orwell had a good analysis of the totalitarian system, which included that permanent state of war. But there's an alternate dystopia, of course. The other famous one is Huxley's Brave New World, which is very different from Orwell's, and especially since the collapse of the Soviet Union and the growth of the sort of one world, what Peter Lamborn Wilson has called here the McDisney culture, becoming the without competition, at least without that kind of major competition, pushing its way across the world. I've been thinking and saying that Huxley really had it a lot more. I'm a great admirer of Orwell, and for what he was writing about then, it was on target. But that for the long view, for what we're coming to now at least, Huxley had the analysis down of that that world which is ruled not by tight control, not by we will hit you over the head if you don't do what we want, but by what Chomsky calls manufacturing consent, the society in which people are conditioned to accept. And, you know, in as Chomsky says, in the Soviet Union, in Nazi Germany, you do what they want or they have a club. And what you think is not really that important. It's what, you know, everybody, you know, everybody in the, almost in the Soviet Union knew that it was crap and that it was hypocrisy, but you have to toe the line. And this much more sophisticated brainwashing and thought control comes in a society where people have some kind of a say, a token, say, a rubber stamp that's given to them every 4 years, but they then have to be conditioned to, and this is a much more subtle business, and again, to throw out things that if people haven't read, I'm guessing that most people here have read Brave New World, it's worth rereading, but especially Brave New World Revisited, which was an essay that Huxley wrote in 1957. And he said, you know, a quarter century ago I wrote this book, and I said it's 600 years in the future because I didn't know that in my lifetime we would get that much closer to it. And that was now 45 years ago, and boy, we've come so much closer since then. Now I'm beginning to think that there's a sort of, there may be an Orwellization stepping in again, at least to achieve that society, because in fact there were no votes in Brave New World. And there has been voting in our society now, and that's been called democracy. Now, democracy means that the people rule, that the decisions that are made by society, such decisions as are collectively made for the society, are made by the people as a whole. And we haven't had that. I think we all know that. We've had a plutocracy in the form of a democracy. And my academic background is in ancient history, which is why, you know, you say, and I immediately thought of the Assyrians, because in fact the Assyrians did pioneer that kind of really brutal approach of displacing, shipping whole populations back and forth and killing off huge numbers of people and heaping up mounds of skulls. But in fact, that's not the only state model. And a few centuries later, the Assyrians gave way to the Babylonians, but the Babylon fell without an arrow being fired, as it turns out. Cyrus the Great, in some ways, was the first modern state leader, because he offered people a more favorable, or a, let's say a more user-friendly alternative, which was the state that that would not bother you if you went along, that would not overtly hit you over the head. And in a world where everybody's hitting you over the head, that was somewhat desirable. Anyway, coming from an ancient history point of view, I now look at this moment we're in, this moment, just the last year and a little more, as being that transition when the Roman Empire went from being a nominal democracy, which was very tightly controlled by small ruling powers, which meant mostly the very rich and the traditional political families, to an open or an overt empire. I mean, actually, the term empire means when Rome ruled the world, and the term that's used by historians is principate, to mean when there were emperors running the empire. And this, I think, is important and relevant now, because America is pretty clearly the new Rome. It's that single power dominating the world. Okay, the Roman world actually didn't extend throughout the entire world the way that America does, but the known world to the Romans was almost exclusively Roman, and those areas that weren't in the Roman Empire were largely dominated by the Roman Empire, or, failing that, were defined politically by the fact that they were opposing the Roman Empire. So they get you coming or going. And this transition is something that de Tocqueville also wrote about in being, as he always was, very farsighted about democracy in America. And he said in Democracy in America somewhere, and I was trying to find it over the last few days and couldn't dig it up, but he did say somewhere that when America ceases to be a democracy, and becomes, then the transition will take place in a very short period of time, but the outward forms of the democracy will be maintained, and the pretense of democracy will be held. Well, what we've had in, as I say, in Rome, they had a very tightly controlled system, but the people did have votes. And then they continued to have elections. You know, consuls continued to be put in power. They were pretty much pre-selected by the emperors afterwards, and the emperors were those who ruled, but they kept some of the forms of the democracy afterwards. We've reached that point. The benefits, I mean, as we know, I think we know in this room, that this country was a plutocracy even over the last 10, 20, however many years, and not a democracy, because not a real democracy where the people decide what's going to happen, because these elections have to do with and it's, there's no secret about this. The pundits sit around on CNN at the beginning of the election season and in the op-ed pages of the Times, and what do they talk about? Well, this guy is not a serious candidate. He doesn't have a big enough war chest. This one is. He's had enough contributions. He can be serious. So who's a serious candidate is decided by who the rich give their money to. The rich pre-select them, and then we get to pick whether we want Clinton or Dole, who are going to do almost exactly the same things. And where they differ, it's where different factions of the rich and powerful have their differences, which they do in almost any system except the most extreme dictatorships. The Soviet Union was ruled by the Communist Party, and there were factions and wings of the Communist Party that had different points of view, and they worked out within that leadership, without giving the people as a whole any chance even to rubber stamp it, what was going to be the decision, and then they all went along with that decision. And the transition to that came along pretty quickly last year when we discovered in these fairly unimportant elections where we get to decide, you know, which of the rich's candidates were going to be chosen, the rich and the powerful and the politically connected traditional families and so on were decided that they were going to just sit down and work it out for themselves and then present it to the rest of us. And, you know, Al Gore, who was supposedly the loser, is in fact part of that inner circle that was part of that ruling class. And, the point is that there was a minimal value to democracy and votes, which is that there's a certain amount that there's a minimum, there's like a floor. If you do things too appalling, people will turn away, or they'll turn to your enemies. And they're taking that even away. Just a couple of other points, and then we'll pass it along here. I think that in reacting to this, we have to You were talking about the only way to oppose it is to be an anarchist. I would go the other way. I would say the only way, you know, these things are not wrong because we're politically on one side and other people are another, or because of ideological positions. These things are wrong because they're wrong. And what's, I mean, I'm not against war because war expands the power of the state and does not. I'm against war because killing other people is wrong. Killing other people, except in the most extreme case where somebody's about to kill you. Real self-defense. Killing people when there's any kind of a choice about it is wrong. And you were talking about World War I. Bertrand Russell, Albert Einstein, these were very prominent voices against the war who were not anarchists. I think what we have to avoid that ideologizing, casting things into terms of a prefabricated structure of ideas, and really go with what hurts people and what doesn't hurt people, what allows people control over their own lives and what doesn't. And the last thing I'm going to say is, if you sit down in a coffee shop somewhere, in a diner next to somebody, and you say to them, the hegemonistic rule of the hereditary ruling classes and the plutocracy dominates the pseudo-democracy of our society, while actually leaving all power in the hands of an inner circle of the ruling class, they're going to move away from you like you're spreading anthrax around. But if you sit down and you say to them, you know, the rich just buy those fucking politicians and get them to do whatever they want, you know, and we're all sitting here like saps, they're going to nod and say, yeah, man, what a, you know. And the more we talk the first way, the more people are going to move away from us and start pulling out their flags and waving them. And the more plain-spoken we can be and pointing out, as Chomsky does, yes, over and over, and including, by the way, in that article, he does not, as soon as Bob finished, the pieces that Bob read were over, he goes right back to bashing imperialism, but by showing case by case how America, in Central America, mining the harbors of Nicaragua, was terrorist, and so on and so on. Okay.
So, you want to learn to speak the right way, you got to go down to Texas. I really think it's, they know how to think and talk. Now, last person on the panel. Who, have you ever been to any one of our meetings before? So you don't. Any of these forums?
No.
Sylvia, particularly would like to be identified as a feminist, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. And I was reading through the Autonomedia list of books that are going to come out, and you have one that's coming out. If you might mention what you wrote on, and then maybe people will have an idea of more of what you're about.
Oh, it's a book called Caliban and the Witch, and it's a book about the condition of women, the changes in the condition of women, and the witch hunt in the transition from feudalism to capitalism.
Okay, great. But
so
you're not.
And also the conditions of women in the transition, the changes in the condition of women, in the change from feudalism to capitalism. Okay, I'm going to make very few points and then speak longer maybe in the discussion, because there's a lot of people and I really feel the discussion should be opened. But I want to begin by agreeing with the last speaker. I'm sorry I don't remember your name.
Jay,
that you don't have to be an anarchist to be against this war. And in fact, speaking as a feminist, it seems to me that feminists and women in general have been always against war. And I am especially appalled this time, as in every other war that has preceded it, because this war comes now after many, 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 just in the last 10 years. It seems that we never stop in a war. The war against the Gulf War seems not long ago, and then the war against Yugoslavia, now the war against Afghanistan, and now we're talking about another 5, 6, 7, 10, maybe, did Cheney say 40 nations might be at risk of being bombarded. So, yes, a condition of permanent war. I'm particularly appalled that, in this case, above all, the justification or the reasons that has been given to make this war more acceptable to the broad public has been the claim that it has liberated women, that in fact it has promoted, you know, women's emancipation in Afghanistan. And I want to say how appalling and absurd, and if you look at that claim, you can begin to see, it's not of course the only type of evidence, but you can begin to see that what is being claimed is very different from the reality. You know, first of all, it is only when the United States government has begun to fall out and unicorn with the Taliban that they have discovered that women in Afghanistan were oppressed. Until then, no matter what type of atrocities or what type of abolition of women's rights were practiced, no mention was made of it. It is only roughly speaking around 1998 that they discovered that actually women Afghan, you know, were oppressed. Second of all, and even more important, how can you speak, you know, of women's emancipation when in fact you are busy destroying their children, destroy their most basic forms of livelihood, displacing thousands and thousands of women, in fact more than 1 million people have been displaced from their families, sending them away from their countries, many, in many, many cases, particularly older women and children, to, I'm sure, certain death. We will never know how many people, you know, have actually died, you know, because of this war, aside from those that have been bombarded, the many villages that have been wiped out, of which, you know, we are told that it's difficult to keep track of such things. But on the ground, people are keeping track. In addition to the prisoners who have been butchered, and I know it's, I watched the French news, and a news was given there that I never saw in the paper. Maybe I missed it. But there was news about hundreds and hundreds of Taliban prisoners who were moved from Kunduz to a prison, and they were put in containers and made to travel for 3 days without air. And one of the few survivors, they practically arrived all dead, and one of the few survivors told to foreign journalists about how they would crowd around this little hole that there was in the container in which this person was, trying to breathe some air, and most of them arrived dead. Right, so there's many, many more casualties than we are usually told. But in addition to that, right, it's very clear that even at the beginning of this war, you know, a fantastic, an incredible disaster was in the make because of the number of refugees who would not receive food through the winter because of the bombing and because of the closing of the border with Pakistan and because of the many more people who had been displaced by the bombing themselves, in addition to those who were already displaced because of the drought and the previous war against the Soviet Union. So when I think of this, and then I am asked to believe that this war is going to be a plus for women. Now, knowing, in fact, that these women are the same mother and wife and sister and daughters of the people who have been killed. It's enough. It's already a major contradiction. But there's also something else, which is much has been made of the fact that after the setting up of the new government and the defeat of the Taliban, now girls are going to be allowed to enjoy more rights, go back to work, and even go to school. And here, too, I want to say something. In great part of the third world, girls don't have access to school. I know for a fact in the case of Africa that because of the World Bank policies, because of the IMF policies, practically even primary education is now off limits to millions of children, even boys, not only girls. Right? In other words, a situation has developed where practically very, very few children, children of middle class and upper class, mostly, you know, are able to go to private schools, whereas the public system, even at the elementary level, has completely collapsed or is in such dilapidated condition. In fact, what is happening now in a number of African countries, you know, what the World Bank is implementing is what they call multiple shifts. Multiple shifts means that in one morning, where the public system is still working, you know, in one morning, you have four or five shifts of students being taught by a teacher, all for 1 hour, right? Because the teacher does not have much time because that teacher is not being paid. So you're talking about a de facto situation in which millions and millions of children have no access to educational system. And of course, girls even more, because whenever there is a choice in the family, it's the girls that is, you know, discriminated. Now, so why don't we hear about those girls? Why do we not hear about those girls whose education is being prevented? Or does education have to be prevented only in particular ways? Or is the country that counts? We have never heard any word of appropriation about the fact that the World Bank is practically depriving, you know, children of education, right? So again, this is a matter, as you said, of common sense. You don't have to be a great political analyst to see that it's something which is clearly in contradiction with the claim that this war is actually a plus for the Afghani population and in particular for women. And in the same way, we don't hear anything about, you know, the many women that because of the globalization process, today have to leave their countries from the Philippines, from Thailand, and many times have to go across the world to abandoning their families, having to leave their families behind. And many times they are also caught up in true slave trade network. Right? Throughout Europe now, and also in the United States, there is a new slave trade. There's a slave trade in women, and the word is not an exaggeration. You basically, again, because of the impoverishment that the World Bank and the IMF have plunged people into, you have a situation where practically throughout Western, Eastern Europe, or parts of Africa, literally, your own kins, brothers, or lovers may sell you into slavery. Right? This is not the place tonight to talk about that, but this is something that I'm personally very concerned with because it's a phenomenon that is incredible, really incredible. Women are being kidnapped, and these are not just isolated cases. I mean, they're literally being kidnapped as they go about their business, and, you know, the same night they will find themselves on a boat that takes them to the shores of Italy, and the next day they will be in some place prostituting, and they will be killed or face atrocious torture if they protest or if they try to escape. This is a very broad phenomenon, quite public. People know about it. But we don't hear about it. So again, it's very hypocritical, you know, to say the least, you know, to use, for example, the situation of women, as it has been done, you know, in Afghanistan, to basically show that this war, in fact, represents for certain sectors of the Afghani population a form of social progress. Okay, now, the second point I want to make is that when I was thinking of, especially again as a woman, as a feminist, and being very concerned with the condition of women in globalization, the condition of women in war, and the condition of women, particularly in countries, you know, where there's been applied, like countries of the Middle East, Muslim countries, Islamic fundamentalist countries, where there's been a, you know, systematic discrimination against women. I've been trying to understand, you know, what kind of society, what kinds of vision of society, you know, those Islamic fundamentalism has tried to propose. And I want to share with you a few points, a few ideas that I've developed, and then try to make a political point about it, and then see, maybe you can help me to develop them, right? One of the things that I've tried to understand has been to what extent what is called Islamic fundamentalism, right, to what extent it has represented something of an alternative for the millions of people, the populations of many countries. It has represented an alternative to globalization. And I've asked this, I've raised this question, because it is very clear, it is an historical fact. It's widely documented that the development of Islamic fundamentalism in our time, because it's not a new phenomenon, but in our time, really begins with the 1980s in places like Egypt, Algeria, in places where the nationalist project that had developed with the end of colonialism basically had failed. And basically it had failed because the countries involved had gotten into debt. They had to return to the World Bank, the IMF, and in the process, they had to apply severe austerity programs. And those austerity programs created widespread protest. The bread riots in Egypt of 1976, and you know, similar, you know, massive social protests later in Algeria and later on in Morocco, right, have been really the soil, and this is very well documented, in which Islamic fundamentalism has begun to grow. And it grew, presenting a vision, a certain vision of society, right? Presenting the idea of a society that would be neither capitalist nor socialist, and a society that, this at least was the self-presentation, a society that would be more egalitarian, that would not lose sight of solidarity, that would avoid deep differences between classes, and of course the society also will be deeply patriarchal, right? And a society that would be disconnected by the global market, by the global commodity market, in the sense that people will not have much access to consumption, to the commodities provided by the global market, but at the same time could have certain guarantees, at the same time could have certain basic safety nets, and, for example, would be able to have jobs, small trades, etc., etc., etc. Okay, now, this is what Islamic fundamentalism seemed to be in the early 80s, when it began to proselytize, and for example, in places like Egypt, provided, you know, a set of grassroots clinics, right, to people at the time in which the public health education system were falling apart, right? Or, for example, they also provided basic, you know, schooling for primary school children and so forth, right? Now, it seems another step in that process clearly was the Iranian Revolution, right? And two, the war in Afghanistan. I think that the Iranian Revolution and the war in Afghanistan were two important developments in the history of Islamic fundamentalism in our time. Why? And here I'm going to make broad generalizations, so forgive me if I'm not going to be very, very, but it seems to me that out of those two situations came a project in certain sectors of the Middle Eastern bourgeoisie, which was in a way to again support, through the use of oil money, to support a certain type of society, a certain type of social organization based on this vision of Islam, on the basis of a different distribution, a different usage of the oil money. Now, one of the things that I've been interested in trying to understand is to what extent this has really developed roots among people, right? To what extent this has really created roots among the population, again, among workers, among, to what extent it has represented also a sort of a class perspective, a class project. And it seems to me that the conclusion that I've come to, and I'd really like to hear what other people know of, is that it has not succeeded. It has not succeeded for a number of reasons. On one side, as a political project, Islamic fundamentalism was defeated by different types of repression in places like Algeria and Egypt, right? On another, it has turned, and here I hope I it has turned, it seems to me, from a means to protect people from exploitation into an alternative form of exploitation, into an alternative form of exploitation, where, in fact, the disconnectedness from the global commodity market as applied only to the lower echelon of society, whereas large sectors of the bourgeoisie has been able to deal with the commodity market and sell either, you know, through contraband, through drugs, through oil, and create, in fact, an alternative economy which is not alternative to the globalization, but in fact feeds upon globalization. And that the alternative that Islamic fundamentalism seemed to promise at the beginning, in fact, has now materialized. And this perhaps explains, which is something that seems to me, it's something of a fact. This explains why we have not seen the type of protest. We have not seen the type of protest in countries with presumably large Islamic fundamentalist movements that was to be expected. For instance, we have not seen in any country, except a little bit in Afghanistan, the type of social protest that we have seen in Argentina in the last few weeks. Right? People have gone out in Argentina, women 70 years old, the mothers de la Plaza de Mayo and a lot of other women have stood in front of the horses when the horses have charged them, right? Because they were very aware they were protecting their livelihood, the basic, right? But we have not seen that in Islamic country. And it seems to me that there's enough evidence from when one looks at what has happened at the grassroots level, at the type of social organization that Islamic fundamentalism has translated into at the grassroots level, to show that, in fact, it is not correct to read into it a kind of, you know, working class project, a kind of, you know, egalitarian project, more egalitarian project. And this is something that I like to propose. And now, I want to conclude to say that the importance to me is the following, that we have been really been fed and confused a lot with this discourse of the clashes of civilizations. And, you know, for for a number of years, we have been given the impression we are meeting social movements, anti-globalization movement, right? The impression that, you know, when you speak of countries like Egypt, Algeria, and so on, it's another world, right? It's another world. As perhaps at one time, you know, people look at the Soviet Union. In other words, you know, here is the Islamic world, and there is, you know, Islam and the West, and there is a clash of civilization and so forth. Right? In other words, that Islam has been used from all kinds of points of views to keep people divided, to also keep people divided, and that in a way, what is becoming more clear is that, in fact, you know, the type of grassroots mobilization that one would have imagined, assuming that Islam was a certain type of Islam. Let me be precise. A certain type of Islam, belligerent Islam, you know, quote anti-Western Islam, which means anti-Western means anti-everybody, right? Not only against capitalism and so on, but it means presumably anti, you know, any person, the type of project that, you know, inspired the people who bombed the Trade World Center, right? The type of grassroots mobilization has not taken place seems to me to indicate that perhaps the type of barrier the people identified, you know, with Islamic fundamentalism does not exist. And that perhaps, you know, and or likely ways of communication exist that have to be developed. Possibilities exist that have not been developed by the movements in Europe, in the United States, right? And but for that to be possible, clearly, and I think I want to go back to what Bill said at the beginning, right? And I thought it was very, very important what he said at the beginning, that in order to build those connections, right, people have to put in their political program, first and foremost, the rethinking how do we relate, you know, to the question like the question of oil, you know, how do we relate to the fact that we are using on a day-to-day basis literally stolen wealth, you know, we are using wealth that is taken away from, you know, the land of, you know, these, the people of the Middle East and perhaps tomorrow Afghanistan or et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, what Bill was saying about changing, putting as a priority the question of changing our political economy thinking of a society that is not feeding, right, on oil and so forth, and particularly not feeding, you know, on natural resources that are required in the way that they are required. That has to be one of the priority of an anti-globalization movement if it really wants to build the type of connection, the type of solidarity, and the type of understanding and you know, common mobilization that I think, you know, seems to be possible. Okay, that's it.
Well, as Sylvia says, now the interesting, I mean, this is the platform upon which the interesting discussion is going to start taking place when you all start saying what your views are and we get into some more interesting
And before
things.
We do that, by the way, because yes. Ed, you're going to be passing this around, but also, since some people came late, I should say we asked at the beginning if there is anyone here who does not want to appear on videotape, which may eventually run on public access TV, and I know there's one right at the end of the row there, so if the camera does not swing around that way, that would be good. Anyone else? No. Okay. So we'll just... Don't take... Right. Don't take Anonymous's picture.
Right.
Yes, anonymous woman over there.
No, just don't point it that way. That's all.
We pass this around because we do have expenses, mailings, and this space actually costs money.
I'd like to hear because I'm not sure
things.
That you know. What I presented is very touching.
Less if
so
you
I want to know
so
if.
Put it in there. We're going to pass it around this side first, and then this, get it back over
touching,
there.
That's good because if it was harmless, then what would be the point?
Or if it was in a. I will, for a while, identify people, but then after a while the panel can identify who you want to speak. There's a person who had her hand up for a while.
I
had the same problem, but right, that was my problem.
The purported anarchists at the table here who have not even brought up the issue of the whole Islamic fundamentalist thing is a perfect demonstration of the evils of theocracy, of religion, and I'm very confused that you're putting the onus on the United States. I mean, I certainly understand all of the economic issues, and I totally agree that the way is to get off of oil, you know, no question about that. But in fact, I do feel like I'm in danger of being attacked. If I was on one of those airplanes, they wouldn't ask me anything about my politics. I don't feel these people are even a government. I think they're like pirates. And in fact, the war is not against Afghanistan, or I know, whatever, the media, you know. Nobody is calling this a war against Afghanistan. The war
is
taking.
What they call it is not important.
The war is taking place in Afghanistan.
And if you were in Afghanistan, just as if you were on that plane, and you're absolutely right, if you were on that plane, they wouldn't ask you, are you for this or that? You know, those. Of course, those people were pirates. And if you were living in a village in Afghanistan, as many people were, who were bombed and killed, you know, and this happened over and over. The U.S. bombed the same Red Cross warehouse twice. The U.S. has bombed hospitals in Afghanistan. You know, and
well,
if you were living there and the U.S. bombs dropped on you, they wouldn't be asking you, are you pro or anti-US?
Yeah, that's exactly
so killing. No, it's not. It's exactly the same issue.
We're going to have to wait until the dust clears before we're able to really assess the damage. So making, you know, statements about how many people were killed and blah, blah, blah. Nobody really knows at this point.
We know that innocent people were killed.
We do know that innocent people were killed. We know that innocent people were killed here as well.
Yes.
But you know, let's not get into that. Let me just phrase it in terms of a question. Would the panel please discuss the relationship of religion to war?
We could discuss that all night, but if I can briefly throw a stick at your question here. Your government, through its criminal actions in the Middle East and in the Islamic world, has made you a target of completely barbaric, reactionary, and evil terrorists. Those reactionary, evil, barbaric terrorists, in fact, have been set up by your government. Your government poured $5 billion into the Mujahideen in Afghanistan in the 1980s, and even after the Taliban emerged, continued to fund the Taliban under the table through Pakistani intelligence because they were fighting Russia's surrogate forces in Afghanistan. So, the U.S. has continually, throughout the Cold War, played the card of Islamic fundamentalism against the card of communism. They did it quite effectively in Afghanistan. They kicked out the communists and set up the Islamic fundamentalist regime there, and then just washed their hands like Pontius Pilate and let these, as you correctly point out, completely reactionary, unscrupulous bandits just take power there. Mossad and Israel pretty much did the same thing, where they set up Hamas and funded them under the table to as a countermeasure against the Palestinian Liberation Organization. And, you know, now, lo and behold, there's no more communists left.
And these Islamic fundamentalists, which our government set up as a counterweight to the communists, have become hegemonic, to use that word, in terms of providing the only opposition to U.S. imperialism in the Islamic world. And now we're dealing with an enemy in the Islamic world, an enemy of U.S. imperialism in the Islamic world, which does not share any of, you know, our basic values of elementary rights for women, of economic justice, of secularism, of pluralism, of any of that. We have our government has created through its actions this quite legitimate and scary enemy. But ultimately, it's a product of U.S. imperialism. So that's why we oppose our government.
Now, would any of the panel like to respond to the question about
the role of God
theocracy?
Yes.
Sylvia had her hand up on the panel first.
I don't know. You know, again, it's something that I'm trying to work out. But I would advise you to read a few things. For example, the book by Lashid on the Taliban. There is a chapter in it, if I can find it. Well, I can tell you afterwards. But it's a very interesting chapter. You know, the Taliban are presumably the epitome, right, of religious purity. You can even listen to the radio, band, and so on, all in the name of the purity and so on. Actually, it turns out there's nothing to do with religion.
You're fascist.
It turns out they're running this great contraband, fantastic contraband scheme. They're dealing with Mercedes. They're basically working as part of one broad mafia, drug mafia, transport mafia, which is dealing with Mercedes, is dealing with British underwear, what have you, right? Which they are importing and exporting to Pakistan through different ways. There's very little religion when you go and look into it. And when then you begin to make a little translation, and you realize the purity of Islam means, okay, since you're poor, it was very good that I teach you the purity of Islam, so you don't have to have a TV, you don't have to have this, you don't have to have that, right? And purity of Islam means low budget, actually means austerity, right? And that's what I'm beginning to translate. I began to this idea, in fact, of theology, right? But it turns out that, in fact, there's very little to do with Islam. Very little to do with Islam. There's a lot to do instead with a new type of phenomenon, right? Where you have a class of males and so on, usually middle class, upper middle class, right? Who, in fact, through globalization, have found many avenues of accumulation, money-making, prestige-building blocked. And that, in a sense, have worked out, if you want, a new social scheme, right? And a new social scheme, which, however, requires them to be very involved with the global market. Right, with the global market in one capacity or the other.
So it's
the Taliban are into opium and smuggling, right? And then there is the question of oil and et cetera, et cetera. So I would really, I don't see the question of religion. And in fact, even when it comes to the question of women, there's nothing having to do with religion. I mean, it seems that very clear that low budget economy.
Let me explain to you. They have set up a state based on God. It's God and the state. They've made God and the state together.
The state is built on child labor and women labor. It's a different type of enslavement where women are not sold on the street in miniskirts as in prostitution, which is the free market form of the sale of women. And instead, the woman is enslaved within the home, within a more, in a society that is built on.
I have a feeling that what's coming out here is you're saying that religion is sort of the coat, the propaganda thing that fits over what's really happening, which is really involved with money and the state.
Right. Anybody else? The last time I was involved in anarchism, we were against God and the state, and I have not heard any kind of analysis. The title of this program was, What is the War in Afghanistan About?
It's not about God.
They don't seem to think it's about God, but maybe Eric does. Do you think it's about God?
I agree with Bill and with Sylvia that when you actually look at it, God doesn't have a whole lot to do with what the actual machinations that are going on here. Now, it is true that fundamentalist Islam has a sort of a populist appeal in the Middle East. Okay, and the reasons for that also don't have necessarily that much to do with religion. But it's true there is a sort of a populist fundamentalist Islam that has appeal, and that's why you see Osama bin Laden on garden ornaments and things like that in the Middle East. Now, what does an anarchist say to that? That's what you want to know. What an anarchist says to that is the following: that and some, this may be controversial to some people, but in effect, there has been a sort of a cultural war against Islam. Okay, there has been Western corporations, governments, military, etc., none of which really, at a gut level, recognize Islam as being a legitimate thing. They think it's a primitive religion. If you ask Admiral Crow or Vice President Cheney, on a gut level, what they thought if their son or daughter married an Islamic person, they would say, that's a primitive religion. I don't want that's the basic attitude. Now, anarchists, if you look at, for example, the fact that I, for one, support the Zapatistas, we tend to be, a lot of us are involved in the anti-globalization movement. Okay, what is that about? That's about diversity. That's about saying that one particular system doesn't have a monopoly on what's correct for every single society in the world. It's not the business of the United States to tell the Afghans how to run themselves. The Taliban are a horrible group, but it doesn't help to get rid of the Taliban to give weapons. Essentially, Afghanistan's problem, as I see it, is that countries in the region and around the world have been giving weapons to different factions in there for 25 years. It has not stopped with this war. It's continued with this war. This war has made that even a more violent process. Everybody is arming them, and so they go and they kill each other because that's how warlords behave. Now, Islam is involved here because essentially part of the root of the anger, is the fact that the Western powers that are attempting to change the culture of the Middle East through oil exploitation, etc., are refusing to let the people there have their culture or to develop their culture independently. And I think that's why fundamentalist Islam particularly has a lot of populist appeal, because it seems at least it's something that's culturally within them. As an anarchist, I'd say stop oppressing them, leave them alone, and you won't get Islam, or you're very much less likely to have Islam turn into some sort of a virulent terroristic thing.
I'm just going to, and then I'll stop.
Okay.
The issue, I can't, I guess I'm not communicating very well. Let me put it another way. What contact have you had with the anarchists in Afghanistan? The Afghanistani anarchists.
I don't know any. Do you know any?
There aren't any Afghan anarchists per se that I'm aware of. Excuse me. But there is the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan, RAWA, and we have been striving vigorously to try to provide a voice for them here in New York City.
Yes.
And they are thoroughly opposed to the Taliban, thoroughly opposed to the Northern Alliance, thoroughly opposed to all of the fundamentalist factions. They've opposed them right from the very beginning, and they continue to oppose the new regime, which U.S. imperialism has just installed in Afghanistan, and continue to oppose the bombing and the military intervention in Afghanistan. So if you're looking for somebody with bona fides to support women's rights defiance of fundamentalist theocracy, I suggest that you log on to www.rawa.org. And we've been doing, I'm glad you're cool with RAWA, all right?
Right.
We're doing everything we can to support them and provide a voice for them.
We that may be enough for this question.
I think so.
Since you asked, I don't have any connections with Afghan anarchists, only with the next country over, which is Iran. I have a couple of friends who are highly involved with them, put out a paper called Roshanai, which is Persian for enlightenment, which is a completely anti-religious, anti-Islam, and other organized religion and anti-authoritarian Iranian newspaper. It's been coming out for years now from here in New York. You know, so I have absolutely no brief for Islam, which is, you know, almost as primitive a religion, I guess, as Christianity and the others that we're saddled with over here. But if you want to look at Iran, I mean, for until this last, until, you know, September 11th, the great boogeyman in the Western eyes, the great Islamic horror was Iran, the paradigm of the terrible theocracy, which it is. I mean, as I say, I have friends who, you know, can't go back there or they're be like that. It executes people on a scale practiced other, you know, exceeding anywhere in the world except for China and maybe the U.S. Probably even exceeds the U.S. These are the major executing states in the world. It is illegal for women to go out with their without their hair covered. It is, you know, an extremely repressive fundamentalist state. And at the same time, and all the things that we know and we hear and condemn Iran for are true, and it deserves to be condemned, at the same time, when you compare it with that great U.S. ally, Saudi Arabia, on whose behalf or with whose help these wars in the Middle East are being waged from Iraq to here. I mean, women are not allowed to go out with their faces uncovered in Saudi Arabia. In Saudi Arabia, nobody has a vote. In Iran, women run for parliament and are elected.
Thank you. Let's see. As there, I've noticed.